Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen. Just slightly more than 10 years ago, the first issue of Wired hit the magazine stands. I don't know about you, but I was instantly hooked. Here was a magazine that proclaimed the digital revolution was at hand, that the old, boring, stifling forms of authority would soon be simply obsolete, and that computer technology was restructuring every aspect of our cultural and political lives. I loved it, and even if I wasn't quite smart enough to see how this was all unfolding, Wired magazine gave me hope that I might be. Plus, it just looked really cool. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about the story of Wired, a story that also might be a case study of the exercise of hope, dreams, and business in the digital age. Our guest is Gary Wolfe, a regular contributor to Wired and other magazines, and author of the new book Wired, A Romance, recently published by Random House. In many ways, the story of Wired is the story of its visionary and forceful founder, Louis Rossetto, and his partner Jane Metcalf, who essentially willed the magazine into being, and how they tapped into a reservoir of talent and hope for the digital cultural revolution. We'll talk with Gary Wolfe about that story during this hour. As we do so, we invite you into the conversation. This is a call-in show, so if you'd like to join us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest or via the Internet anywhere in the U.S., 800-222-9455. Feel free to join our conversation. And Gary Wolfe joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning. Gary Wolfe?
Yes, hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. It's a very interesting story.
Thanks.
I wanted to, just to start, the emergence of Wired as an actual publication. I want to talk about, you know, essentially how it came into being.
Right.
How improbable it was, given the background and resources of its founder.
Right.
Who is Louis Rossetto?
Louis is somebody who burst on the scene and had a very peculiar and fascinating history. He wasn't a particularly young person. He was in his 40s, and he was a world traveler, really an expatriate. He hadn't lived in the United States for a decade. He had someone who had a burst of fame when he had been a very young man as one of the founding activists of the Libertarian Party. He was part of the sort of far reaches of individualist conservatism back in the 60s. And then he left the country, and he seemed to have a second sense for incipient revolution. He was in Sri Lanka when the Tamil Rebellion broke out. He was in Afghanistan when the CIA started to deliver Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen there, who were fighting the Soviet regime. He was in Italy when the Red Brigade started their kidnapping and murder campaign. And he was in San Francisco for the birth of the digital revolution. And he was somebody for whom those moments of sudden change, even violent change and disruption, were extremely exciting.
What's interesting is as an outsider, someone who simply has read Wired for some time, certainly the promise of liberation through digital technology and networking, et cetera. I mean, that had a resonance for me as whatever political temperament I came from. But I wouldn't have expected the founder to be essentially a libertarian.
Yes, it's very unlikely. And one of the things that I think that gave Wired its peculiar character was the way it harnessed some of the utopianism that really was a strain in American culture that had burst forth the last time in the 60s. And, you know, you saw that in its day-go glow colors and its whole tone. It harnessed that that part of sort of the American genome to a very particular political vision, what they call in Europe liberalism, but which really means it, libertarianism, free marketism, you know, Adam Smithism, this sort of thing. And so it turned those utopian impulses to a new kind of radicalism, and one that was really exciting to some people, really offensive to other people, but always very theatrical.
Certainly. Well, let's talk about a little bit before Wired started. Louis was working essentially in Europe and sort of a bohemian lifestyle.
Yes.
Was he really adept at computer technology, or how did he become interested in the role computers could play in human liberation or transformation?
It's a good question, because he also had a special connection, in a way, to a certain part of the history of technology. His father was a printing engineer, and he worked for a company that very few people have heard of, but was an extremely important company called Mergenthaler Linotype. It was based in Brooklyn. Otmar Mergenthaler, at the turn of the century, invented the first movable automatic typesetting machine. You know, before then, people had to pull little bits of type off of trays and arrange them, and then they would be scrambled up and, you know, rearranged. Next time you wanted to print a page, it was very time-consuming and laborious, and the search for a way to do this automatically was extremely important at the turn of the century. In fact, Mark Twain went broke backing a competing machine, and he, you know, had to go into exile himself for a few years. Well, Otmar Mergenthaler's company continued to be an innovator in print technologies, and Louis Rossetto's father had helped to invent the Linotron, which was the first electronic typesetting machine. And Louis Rossetto, as a young man, had a connection to these technological transformations, but also as a political person and somebody who came of age in the 60s, he saw these machines and the transformations they went through as more than something that would bring convenience to professional typesetters. He saw them in the whole history of revolutions in print technology, starting with Gutenberg, as tools of revolution. And so when he was in Europe, he was working eventually for a small translation company in Amsterdam, where he put out a newsletter for translators and other people who worked with complex issues of publishing. And that was where he really got his first look at desktop publishing and thought, you know, okay, a lot of people are going to make money off this, fine, but it can also mean something socially and culturally and politically.
He was also extremely adept at sort of, I don't know what verb to use here, wheedling or convincing or cajoling people into essentially supporting his dreams.
He had a very peculiar type of charisma, you know, a combination of confidence and vulnerability, I would say, that made him almost irresistible in certain circumstances. He was somebody who was so well-informed, who was so sure of himself, and yet his ideas were so extreme that I think he could be pretty off-putting when you first met him. But time and time again, he was able to pull resources essentially out of nowhere, bring people in to volunteer for his project. I mean, they produced this magazine on zero money. Attract really important technologists and thinkers to put their imprimatur on it. And, you know, they eventually got enough money to print one issue of the magazine. That was in 1992. And I don't think they really knew what would happen after they published that issue. They would be out of money, and maybe the game would be over. Instead, that issue was released and became an instant astounding success, something that even rattled them. They had no idea what to do with the sacks and sacks of mail that started to arrive in their office requesting copies of the second issue.
Well, before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about prior to Wired. There was a magazine that Lewis was editing in Europe. Electronic Word, is that?
Yes. That was the magazine that he produced under several publishers. It began as a company organ for this technology firm that was interested in translation and document production. Then they canceled it because it really didn't do much for their business. It was a visionary publication in the wrong context, and he took it to another publisher, published it for about a year and a half there, and eventually that publisher killed it. and then he was an editor without a magazine.
But essentially, they were publishing the magazine for one reason, and Lewis was essentially hijacking it for his own.
That's exactly right. They were publishing a magazine for professional translators and document producers in big corporations across Europe, and Lewis was covering some of that stuff, but really focusing on the big story as he saw it, which was the effect that desktop publishing and network computing was going to have on our entire lives.
Yeah. So then he comes to the United States after this stint in Europe, and he's sort of developed his vision for what he wants to do. It was interesting reading your book because I'd also read Michael Wolff's book, Burn Rate, which you refer to the story of his meeting with Michael Wolff, and Michael Wolff essentially says, "This guy's nuts. He wants money to do what?"
Yes, you know, that's interesting that you also read that book. You know, I found it interesting to get that story from two different perspectives. Uh-huh. Michael Wolff's book is a very funny book, and he describes that meeting with Lewis as really just meeting with somebody who was absolutely clueless,
right.
Somebody who the last person you would imagine to be successful in any field, never mind in publishing or editing, somebody who you wouldn't even hire. You know, somebody who was essentially hopeless. Now, I think that's an exaggeration, but it's an interesting exaggeration. And the reason it's interesting is that Michael Wolff was also an aspiring newspaper editor and publisher at that time. He had a magazine which he never got off the ground, but he was working in New York, and he was very attentive to the opinions and the beliefs of the magazine mainstream in New York City. And from that perspective, I think his description of Lewis is completely accurate. In a sense, Michael Wolff represents what you would have thought of Lewis had you already been inside the world of successful magazine publishing, because Lewis certainly was outside that world. What Michael Wolff misses in that story, and I think makes it more interesting, is that Lewis had a grasp on the potential effect of technologies on culture that was also missing from that world. You know, so that Lewis was bringing something foreign into the mix, and he was rejected. He was rejected like a virus, you know, or something, and ended up working out of San Francisco, which if anybody who knows about publishing knows that San Francisco, while it has a lot of charms and virtues, is really on the margins of the mainstream publishing world.
Well, let's talk about that mainstream publishing world a little bit, because usually when somebody starts a magazine, they need a whole lot of money. And you know, essentially experience, and there's these sort of this paradigm for magazine publishing that Lewis, as you say, certainly didn't fit.
Yes, and you know, I don't think this is in the book, but I was recently looking at some, I believe they were guesses, educated guesses, as to how much Miramax Films and Tina Brown, the former editor of The New Yorker, spent launching the magazine Talk, which you may remember from a couple of years ago.
Barely.
Yeah, that was the big magazine launch of 2000 or 2001. They spent $40 million launching that magazine, which barely, you know, made an impact and then disappeared. $40 million is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Lewis and his partner Jane started out with basically no money, with a $20,000 gift, more or less, from a friend in Amsterdam. Then they raised from a couple of well-known technology people, including Nicholas Negroponte, who was the director of the Media Lab at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They raised $225,000. And it was with that money that they brought out their first issue.
They also had, as I sort of alluded to in the introduction, a sort of reservoir of talent, people they had mostly convinced, you know, to be part of this, although maybe with ambivalence, especially the art director.
Yes.
John
Plunkett.
Plunkett, thank you. I didn't want to confuse his name with the other John involved in the story.
Yes.
Who had a very, very interesting approach to design that was, again, sort of way outside the paradigm.
Right.
But yet it was perfect for what Lewis had in mind.
Well, there's sort of two issues there, and maybe I'll just talk for a minute about both of them. The one is about the reservoir of talent that they were able to call on, often for almost free. I think their standard pay for for a lot of the people in their office during that first time was $100 a week. You know, it's hard to remember, but It seems like so much longer ago than it really is. But
yes.
Wired was started in just at the very first hints of a resurgence after the first Gulf War. And in a way, the whole history of the magazine is the history of something that happened in a period of optimism between two wars. You know, you can say in a way that the boom ended more or less at the time of the second Gulf War, and it began, you know, soon after the end of the first Gulf War. And it was a period where there was an economic resurgence and also a resurgence of hope and of optimism. Well, at the very beginning, that hadn't quite happened yet. So they're out in San Francisco, which is outside the publishing mainstream. The economy's in the dumps. You know, there's not too much that's interesting going on. And that, in an ironic way, is a very fortunate moment in which to start a utopian publication, because you've got plenty of utopians around who have nothing better to do.
Right.
Now, John Plunkett is an interesting case because he's somebody who had been a corporate designer. And he told me at one point that he was used to working on projects where he spent $10,000 on a single photograph. And $10,000 was the entire design budget for the first issue of the magazine. He and his partner, Barbara Kerr, had taken a step back from the New York life that they had been in. They'd been very successful designers in New York City, and they'd moved out to Park City, Utah. And, you know, the last thing they really thought they were going to do was devote the next 7 years of their lives to a hellacious a startup magazine experience. But I think that John, like so many people, was captured by Lewis's vision, and he saw a chance to do something interesting in the world of design. And he's really the one who brought that 60s day glow look, who recognized that something could be recaptured of the past and repackaged as a type of futurism. And the magazine's design was one of the most influential things about it. You saw it imitated in advertising, in other magazines, even in packaging and things like that. I think we live in a world now very much, if not controlled, then sort of sparked by Plunkett's design for Wired.
Absolutely. Well, I've got a couple issues here in front of me, and to this day, I'm still not sure which pages are the advertisements and which are the content.
Yeah, you know, and in fact, Plunkett's original idea was even more extreme than that. His thought was, let's make a magazine in which every page is unique, in which no page continues a design motif from the page before. Mm-hmm. A magazine that's a series of billboards, in a sense, where every time you turn the page, you see something new, new fonts, new layout, new colors, you know, exactly the opposite of what people consider to be good design for a book or a magazine, where it's easy on the eyes and you know where you are and, you know, this sort of thing. I think it was Lewis who asked John to dial that back a little bit, you know, and eventually they settled on having continuity in the form of page numbers, you know, which you can find if you look, and a certain continuity in the fonts and stuff like that. But really, he almost achieved that goal.
Let's talk a little bit about the vision and really what it was all about for Lewis, the Wired Manifesto.
Yes.
What was that all about? What was he trying to do?
This was the thing that was the most exciting about the magazine and the most hard to swallow at the same time, and the one that really continues to be a sort of undigested contribution to, you know, media. Lewis believed that computers were going to make every existing institution obsolete. Authorities that people had taken for granted for hundreds or even thousands of years were going to crash to the ground because of the radicalizing effect of computer technology and network technology. Government, in particular, was something he considered to be a relic from a former time. And so when he put out the magazine from the very first issue, what he wanted to concentrate on was the extreme effects that computers were having on society. He thought, you know, the big media firms would be transformed or vanished. He thought the financial system, the tax system, you know, everything that forms the infrastructure of our communities would be turned upside down. It's funny to wonder, you know, how much he was right. It's very popular now to say all of that is completely wrong. You know, the thing was a fantasy and a dream, kind of a delusion, if not an outright hallucination. But I'm not sure that that's true. I think instead what Wired got wrong was something about the pace of change. Because it was visible, you saw what it could do. Wired expected it to happen, you know, in the blink of an eye. And instead, you know, it turns out that we're still really on day one of those changes.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, and it's also interesting that the first issue came out, I believe, January 1993.
That's it.
Just really 3 or 4 months before another development about three blocks from here, the initial version of Mosaic was released to the public.
Yes, that's right. That was right there.
Yeah, just, you know, I can almost see the building, you know, from my window. That's our claim to fame here. Among our claims to fame.
Uh-huh. Well, it's a big claim, at least in our world.
Yeah, well, and this is a development that really I don't think anybody foresaw. I mean, certainly it contributed to Lewis's sense of inevitability in terms of the dream that he had. But even perhaps it took him by surprise.
Well, that's also touches on what I think is a kind of fascinating issue. I've read some very funny criticisms of Wired, one of which was made in one of the reviews of the book that said, you know, nowhere in this book does it acknowledge that there wasn't a single web page discussed in Wired's first issue. And, you know, that's a humorous remark because Wired's first issue predated the release of Mosaic.
Right.
And the web, although it had been presented in a technical conferences by Tim Berners-Lee, you know, who had invented it, it wasn't being used. So Wired, in a sense, described a world that didn't exist yet. And I think that that's not as uncommon as it might seem. In a way, Wired was a cultural anticipation of a technological development. The potential for that technology was already clear to people who were, paying attention. But the technology itself, the specific form, hadn't come into being yet. And I think it's an interesting question for, you know, people who have a more, rigorous approach to history of technology than I do. Does this happen? Is this how it works? Does the culture prepare itself first and then the machine comes afterwards rather than the machine coming first and the culture adjusting afterwards? And I think Wired, you know, for a study like that, Wired would be a really interesting example. Wired was saying what machines would do that didn't exist yet, and some of those machines came into existence promptly.
That's very interesting. We're almost at our midpoint here with Gary Wolfe. He's the author of the book we're discussing, Wired, A Romance. He's a longtime writer for Wired magazine, and he has written for other magazines. And his other book that I know of, anyway, is a book called Dumb Money, which he co-authored with Joey Enough.
Yes.
And we're talking about Wired magazine and a variety of issues that pertain. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number around Champaign-Urbana, again, 333-9455. And toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. So let's talk about, he gets the first issue comes together, and obviously there's a lot of drama involved in that, and what happens? It's instantly a smash. It's just completely unprecedented. What happened with the first issue?
Well, you know, that's something that goes on to, I think, sort of typify so much of what happened in the entire boom. The magazine was a radical endeavor. It was pretty far on the margins of mainstream media. They were planning, hoping to have maybe 10,000 subscribers during the first year. Lewis had a lot of contempt for the way mainstream magazine subscriptions were handled. People who have ever tried to change their address or something for a magazine know that it's changed a little bit now, but, you know, you call a third-party company and, you know, you have to allow 6 weeks for the change to take place. He thought all of that was outdated. He promised that he'd deliver the magazines, you know, from his San Francisco office, that you could call right into the office and get your needs taken care of. You know, they were planning on slowly growing a radical magazine company. Well, you know, at the point where you're dragging huge sacks of mail up the stairs and dumping them out on the floor and, you know, in a snow flurry of subscription requests, all of that goes out the window. And the growth never stopped. They had, instead of 10,000 subscribers in the first year, they had 100,000 subscribers. They were the hottest magazine of the moment. You know, they were talked about in all the mainstream media. There were interview requests. There were conference requests. There was money being thrown at them. Soon after they launched, during that first year, Condé Nast, which is one of the most important magazine publishers in America, they published The New Yorker and Vanity Fair, many other magazines, Vogue, made a very large investment in the magazine. And suddenly, they had a media company. Well, during the next few years, you know, they went on to launch a television division, a web division, a books division, and, you know, got it into their heads that Wired was going to be, you know, the most important global media company of the new century. And that's, you know, that's another story.
Yeah, well, I'd like to talk about that, because suddenly the magazine is successful and money is coming in and subscriptions are coming in, which became, as you said, a problem because they're being all processed there in San Francisco by, you know, a couple of poor people, you know, with their desks piled with bags.
Yes.
But then that wasn't enough for Lewis. He wants to establish a whole new type of media, you know, operation, empire. I'm not sure what you'd call it. Mm-hmm. But you know, he wanted to carry it way beyond the magazine almost immediately.
Yeah, and, you know, in a way, one of the interesting things about the story, I think, is to try and retrospectively guess at how much of what happened was forced upon these folks from the outside, and how much of it came, you know, from their own ambitions and perhaps not completely well-understood fantasies. The rapidity of this change was not just inside Wired, but it was everywhere. You know, what happens after Wired is released? Well, you know, Marc Andreessen creates Mosaic right there, and Mosaic becomes, you know, Netscape, the interface for the internet to the mainstream America. And this is also, you know, perhaps the most important story of the decade. And millions of people start to become involved. Well, this, of course, reaches right in and touches Wired. People are looking to Lewis and looking to Wired as one of the leaders of this new movement. You know, tens of thousands of emails, the phone ringing constantly, people saying, well, what is your website going to be like? You know, can I get the magazine's back issues online? Can I subscribe online? And so sure enough, you know, Wired, as a technologically oriented group of people, they produce a website, and the website instantly becomes hugely popular. And they decide, well, let's try to pay for this somehow. We're not a big media company. We're not, you know, Time Warner. How are we going to get money to support all these people who are putting up our web page? Well, they think, well, how do we do it for the magazine? Let's put up a little rectangular horizontal bar, and we'll put an advertisement in it.
Yes.
Well, that becomes the first banner ad, really, on the World Wide Web. And now they become the leading advertising-supported media company on the web. And, you know, so one thing leads to another. And, you know, there was a time in there, a couple of years after they started the magazine, where 50% of the advertising on the World Wide Web was on Wired.
I want to talk a little bit about, you know, we'll come back to the advertising issue because it's very, very interesting. One of the things that I didn't ask you to talk about is, you know, Lewis, while he had a utopian vision, he was also interested in making money, being a successful business. This was core to his whole notion of the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, this is also one of the contradictions or the ironies that powers the story. We're used to thinking of utopianism as being anti-capitalist. And I think in the history of American utopian movements, most of them are anti-capitalist. They're kind of communalist, if not communist. They involve people trying to figure out how to live in a way that isn't controlled by or influenced so much by money and greed and ambition and things like that. Well, Lewis was a different species. He was a capitalist utopian. He was somebody who believed that if the distorting institutions would get out of the way, institutions like government, capitalism would inherently produce the best of all possible worlds. In a way, it's an old-fashioned idea and really an extreme idea. Because he had that philosophy, it was very hard to resist the blandishments of the financial people who were coming and saying, we'd like to invest in your company. Because if you're somebody who believes that the market is always right, and the market is looking at you and saying, you're right, everything you say is right, can we invest in you? Well, you know, what's wrong with that? You know, you're not in a good position to be skeptical at that moment. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there's a connection between the utopianism, the utopian capitalism, in a way, of Wired's philosophy, and the excesses that the company found itself suffering from during the boom. And I also think that connection operates on a wider level in our culture, because keep in mind that the time of Wired's great success was also the time of the Gingrich Revolution, a resurgent conservatism in America, also a really enthusiastic and self-confident libertarianism or libertarian strain, at least, you know, in the Republican Party. So you have the whole culture saying, hey, the market is always right, communism is dead. You know, if the stock market says it's true, then it must be true. And, you know, these are some of the forces that led to the bubble and the crash.
And they said Wired is right. The digital revolution is going to change everything.
Well, you know, and again, you know, this story kind of doubles back on itself. I guess where I come down is I think that Wired was right about that. You know, Wired was right that these technologies have a radical effect on institutions. They do cause radical reorganizations. They do shift the way things work in media, in finance, in education, in all the ways that it said it would. It may be at a slower pace than the magazine predicted, but that part of it is right. The part of it that is problematic is the part that says the flow of money and the movements of the stock market are, by definition, accurate reflections of what the truth is. Because it turns out that the stock market and the financial system is subject to all kinds of manias and irrationalities. You know, that the most rational participants in the financial markets are people who are skeptical about the financial markets. And, I mean, that's also a bigger story, but, you know, there's been a lot of writing about this. And, you know, you look at somebody like George Soros, you know, who's, in a sense, a manipulator of markets. You know, you find a lot of skepticism about whether markets accurately reflect reality at any given time. Wired didn't have that level of sophistication financially. Wired was vulnerable to the same enthusiasms that affected an ordinary investor in a company like Pets.com, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
It got swept up in what happened.
And I certainly want to talk about that before we run out of time. There's a couple other issues that I want to get to. But there's a really interesting point that you made in the book. And I think it's really true. A lot of the people who were subscribing to Wired and picking it up weren't even necessarily reading it.
Yeah.
That it was something that it was something to be seen with.
Yeah.
Almost. It was, you know, yes, we agree the digital revolution is here, and to prove it, we have Wired magazine on our coffee table. But in fact, you know, this is a fallacy, because in some sense it sort of gives the lie to the digital revolution that it isn't actually here, because nobody understands it yet.
Well, you know, Wired, both Louis Rossetto and John Plunkett, the designer, had, I think, an instinctive and very subtle and clever understanding of the way magazines work. They knew that they wanted to create something that was a talisman, a badge, a sign that you could hang around your neck, in a sense, and say, I know what's going on. Now, a lot of the people who subscribed to Wired did read it, of
yes,
course.
Sure.
You know, there was a core of absolutely passionate readers, and the evidence of that was the incredibly lively and energetic dialogue that those readers had with the editors and the writers via email and mostly, and also via letters. So, you know, it had a core of really passionate readers. But at its height, you're absolutely right. I describe how it's being passed around the halls of Congress, and it's sitting on the desks of venture capitalists, and it's being used wherever somebody wants to say, you know, these changes that seem so confusing and amazing and quick, and they have to do with technologies that you don't really understand, well, come to me, I understand them, and what's the sign of that? I read Wired. They intentionally made Wired something that was a little bit intimidating, something that you had to decipher if you wanted to understand it, that was full of allusions that weren't explained, acronyms that weren't spelled out, you know, and they did that because they wanted it to be a little bit of a hazing, a little bit of initiation, something to say, okay, if I consume this, I'm really in the know. And even if I don't consume it, if I have it, I can pretend that I'm in the know.
So people who had never touched a computer were, you know, subscribing to Wired.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we were getting to the point by the mid-90s anyway, and towards the late 90s, that most people maybe had touched a computer, but if it crashed, they didn't know what to do. You know, and Wired represented both the computer and the crash.
Very interesting. Well, the issue of advertising, which we touched upon, sort of points to a conundrum that was appearing for people engaged in you know, various enterprises about this time, the beginning of the inflation of the dot-com bubble. Everyone was looking for a business plan, and no one could seem to find it.
Yeah.
And Wired was very much a part of that.
Yeah, I think you know, that's one of the more, I think, sad stories that I tell in the book about Wired has to do with Lewis's prescience about what would be needed to make a successful media business on the web. He really did understand that you couldn't just put all of this stuff out there for free and cross your fingers and hope that money would come in the end. And he had, at the very beginning, a well-thought-out idea that, you know, everybody who came to your website would register and you would find out all this information about them and you would serve them advertisements that were customized to their interests. And, you know, he imagined an extremely functional, revenue-generating, futuristic advertising system. Well, when Wired launched its web programs, none of those technologies really were either they didn't exist or if they existed, they were extremely clunky. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, feeling that the changes were going to happen instantly really helped to sink Wired, because today, pretty much exactly 10 years later, 10 years after Wired launched, mm-hmm. you see a lot of media companies beginning to get it right,
yeah.
You know, where they put their archives up on the web and, you know, you pay them some money if you want to read the full stories, and this sort of thing is all happening. We almost take it for granted. But at that time, there really was no revenue model, and it's one of the things that sunk the company.
But your book really describes in detail something that I think we all knew what was happening, and I had no idea of the numbers, but the advertising on the web initially, you know, there was all this enthusiasm and optimism and the assumption that if you put an advertisement, a banner ad, which, you know, you say Lewis was the first to do, on your website, then it would be a tremendously powerful marketing tool.
Gold mine.
And people would pay just amazing amounts of money for a banner ad. Can you talk about that?
Amazing. Well, you know, it was so new, and nobody knew what the right price was. So, you know, if people wanted in and there was no real market and nobody knew what the price was, it gave Wired the ability to set the price at anything they wanted, and they set the price very, very high. And they sold out all their banner ads. You know, but, you know, a year and a half down the road or a couple years down the road, what you had was the invention of search engines. And so, you know, one of the first ones was called InfoSeek. This was long before Google, you know, but, you know, Yahoo got started and, you know, other companies were producing massive amounts of web traffic, and the price of banner ads started to plummet because, you know, now there was a real market. And there were some really fishy things going on in that market at that time, which I do just sort of briefly outline in the book. You know, for instance, at a time when people assumed that there were tens of millions of advertising dollars in the web, moving up towards hundreds of millions, mm-hmm. most of the top 10 advertisers were web publishers themselves.
Yes.
And what they were advertising was their websites. So, you know, Lycos was advertising on Yahoo, and Microsoft was advertising on InfoSeek, and InfoSeek was advertising on Wired, and Wired was advertising on Microsoft. And, you know, so there was a circle of money being passed around. Well, you know, by the tricks of financial accounting that we're also familiar with now, money that came in to support your web site, your banner advertisements, was revenue. And nobody was looking at the expense side of the equation.
Right.
So when I traded advertising dollars with another company, both of our revenues increased. I passed, you know, the $10 to you, and you passed the $10 to me. Now the total advertising revenue in the business is $20.
Right.
We pass it back again to each other, it's $40. And with these kinds of circles, the total revenue numbers climbed sky high. And then the stock market was looking at questions like, well, what are the company's total revenues? And they were getting huge numbers. Mm. And that's part of what caused the bubble and the crash.
Well, I hope we can get to the IPO and what happened with that. We do have a caller to include in our conversation, and I certainly want to include them. So let's talk with a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. One thing that bothered me about Wired magazine, you literally couldn't read it. They used color combinations that could not be read. And I was surprised they kept winning design awards because of that.
Yeah, you know, that's something that you will probably be aggravated to know. Wired people love to hear. And they love to hear it. I mean, it bugged John Plunkett a little bit, who was the designer, because he thought it really could be read. I think Lewis knew that some of the stuff couldn't be read. But if you go back and you look at it page by page, which I had to do when I wrote the book, you find that what you're saying is definitely true, but it's true for a relatively small number of pages. So what they did is they created, you know, problematic moments in the magazine. If it were a piece of music, you would describe it as a moment of dissonance, you know, of disharmony. And that was part of the overall composition. So your feeling of aggravation, it's not, you know, of course you're right. You know, that's a feeling of aggravation that's very real when you come across a page that has, you know, peach-colored letters on a pink background.
Right, that turned me off, and I just shut the magazine.
Right, you know, I think that for every person who it turned off and they shut the magazine, there was somebody else sort of in their core audience who thought, oh, this is really hard. I better try harder to consume this product.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, I think that's certainly true, and it certainly caught the eye. We have just about maybe 7 minutes left, and there's a whole lot we're not going to be able to get to, unfortunately. One of the things that I think is really dramatic and core to the story is, you know, and the story of the whole dot-com bubble is what happened with the IPO for Wired and sort of, you know, the reaction of everyone to that and the timing and how that all played out. And maybe I could ask you to sort of describe.
Yeah, I think the most important thing about that whole process, at least as I describe it in the book, is that Wired, which really did position itself as the leader, as one of the leaders in this whole revolution, as the company that was in the know, eventually finds itself in the same position or similar position of an investor in a bubble company who jumps in and doesn't really know what they're getting into. And the reason that happens is that the stock market takes off and goes crazy. Now, Wired wasn't responsible for that, but, you know, it helped set the stage for it. And at this point, you have companies with very little revenue getting vast amounts of capital from Wall Street, huge, unfathomable. These companies are sitting in that same commercial stew that Wired is in. They're coming back to compete with Wired. They're starting websites themselves. They're starting magazines. There was a whole slew of magazines started. So Wired, in a sense, found itself in a completely unexpected situation. Now, combine that with the fact that its founder and publisher is somebody who believes that the market is always right, and it's got Wall Street, some of the gold-plated banks of Wall Street, banks like Goldman Sachs, coming to them and saying, you know, we can take this company public at a valuation of $500 million, you know. And that kind of temptation was absolutely irresistible. Wired really thought that it could do a good job with the capital it would raise on the public market, and in some sense felt pressured to join in that race since everybody else was in. Not dissimilar to, you know, people who are sitting, you know, with their money in a mutual fund and they're watching their friends score big on, you know, on their internet investments, and finally they can't resist and they throw their money in too. Wired was a hard sell on the stock market for a number of different reasons, one of which was that Lewis really was a radical businessman. He wasn't somebody who came off as a sort of buttoned up, safe executive officer of a public company. And so the attempt to sell Wired to the public for this vast sum of money really came to a very bad and very ugly end.
One of the ironies of that is that the hot-wired end of the operation, the online Wired, was, as an internet company, subject to this notion of the multiple in value that, you know, here's an up-and-coming thing. The internet, everybody knows that it's the future and there's lots of money in it. So it could be valued at many, 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 many times its revenue. And in fact, it wasn't even probably profitable at that point, as opposed to the magazine, which was basically profitable. It was making some money, but it was subject to a different kind of formula because it's a more traditional publishing kind of business. And it seemed to be that one of the strategic errors was to merge those two so that Hotwired and the magazine became part of one company and lost the inflated value that they would have otherwise had.
And that's really the funniest, in a way, thing that happened, although it's funny, it's also sad. But, you know, internet companies that had nothing going for them were being sold on the public markets for such huge amounts of money. Why? Because they were internet companies. Right. They were magic. They were fairy dust. You know, there was no need to look deeper into them because they were internet companies. Here you have Wired, which actually has one of the more successful internet companies at that time, generating, you know, a decent amount of revenue, but vastly unprofitable. So that's the internet company, you know, has extra fairy dust, you know, which should do very well. But unfortunately, it's merged with a magazine company, which is a conventional business. And the magazine company is actually making money, but it's making money as a magazine. And on the stock market, nobody wants to pay, you know, 100 times or 1,000 times or infinitely many times revenues for a magazine company. In a sense, the reality of the success of the magazine company dragged down the fantasy of the infinite potential success of the internet company, and the thing just couldn't be sold. In a way, Wired was too real. The magazine was too real.
That's very interesting. We literally have about 2 minutes left, and I'm sorry there's much more that I'd like to get to, but we've scratched the surface, and for folks who'd like to know more, the book is Wired, a Romance, published by Random House, the author Gary Wolf. And Gary, just, you know, one final note. Lewis is no longer, you know, at least operational with the magazine, but, you know, the story of his exit is certainly dramatic. But one of the points that I wanted to make sure to make is that there's been a lot of great journalism in Wired magazine.
Thank you. I agree, and I think the magazine was a special place. You know, it's some place that was so bold, so unconstrained. You know, it published a 40,000-word story at one point, which, you know, even The New Yorker doesn't do anymore. You know, it really had an ability to be an adventure. And that's something that I think, you know, is wonderful.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have to leave it at that. And again, the book, Wired, A Romance, Gary Wolf, W-O-L-F, is the author. And I'm sure that you could find that in bookstores and libraries. And to you, Gary Wolf, thank you so much for giving us your time. Very, very interesting conversation.
Thank you for having me.